Previously on Obscured.
Nursing as a profession needs to band with law enforcement to develop a model of care for these patients so that they have access to the same resources that other victims of violence do.
Maya Anderson is one of the leading researchers pushing to develop a protocol for healthcare providers to treat people after a law enforcement encounter and to screen for that. If you haven't heard the last episode, we recommend checking it out. This is Obscured, the podcast from Kuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and happen largely out of the public eye. I'm Emily Previty, co-creator and executive editor of Obscured. On this limited series, From Words to Weapons, we're focused on survivors of law enforcement trauma. On this episode, my colleague Stephanie Marudis and I talk with a physician about how law enforcement trauma shows up in her patients.
Joining us from Pittsburgh is Dr. Divya Venkat of the Allegheny Health Network's Center for Inclusion Health. Divya has treated both incarcerated and formerly incarcerated individuals and will share her perspective with us. She's the co-founder and co-director of RIVER, a healthcare delivery program in Pittsburgh for people who are re-entering the community after being incarcerated. And as you'll hear, Divya will share how she and her colleagues navigate patient mistrust in institutions across the board, including the medical field.
You're passionate about your work. What sparked your interest and sort of has fueled your passion, your desire to focus on this population?
I think I initially just started off wanting to work with underserved populations. My parents immigrated from India in the late 80s, and they came to this country with nothing. And they always talked about when they were in India, how they were living in poverty. And when they came here, they had no one, right? Like this idea of home, they had to recreate it. They had to learn how to advocate for themselves. And they're both very educated in India, but they came here with nothing. And just hearing them talk about what they had to face when they came here, like this idea that like they could not advocate for themselves, even though they knew their experiences. I think that just struck me really hard when I was a kid. Probably, you know, we'd go to India and we'd go to the places where they grew up, and they were like not very nice, and they have this great life now. But it took them learning English. It took them learning a totally different way of life. And I think sometimes I just think that's really unfair that anyone has to do that. And so when I think about the people that I work with, I think about how unfair it is that we believe that there is one perfect way of life, that there is one perfect way to live, that there's all these rules that we have to follow in order to fit in. That's not fair. And that's what leads to poor outcomes with anyone. And so when I think about incarceration, it's people who have had their rights taken away from them. They're people who, like, we don't even know. Sometimes it's like the smallest offense. And that offense could be because they were trying to get a meal for the day. Or they were born into a neighborhood where everyone is using drugs, or they have some deep trauma and that's why they started using drugs, or maybe they were prescribed pain medications. And because they had something happen to them that suddenly leads to their loss of rights, we're not treating them like humans. That makes no sense to me. So I think about the people that I work with, and everyone should be treated with dignity. I think about how my parents, when they came to this country, they weren't always treated with dignity. And that kills me, right? Because they're my parents and I love them. But if I extrapolate that to every other person that I see on the streets that are walking around, the patients that I interact with, they deserve that dignity. I'm lucky that I have this medical degree behind my name, but if I can make life better for anyone, I will surely do it. And I will do whatever I can to advocate that every person in this world has rights if I can. Maybe not this world, I live in Pittsburgh, but whatever I can do here, I'll do it.
So your initial work in the Allegheny County Jail, was that part of the standard rotation? Or did you already know you wanted to work with this population or might want to work with people who are incarcerated?
My journey kind of started when I applied to residency. The internal medicine residency program at the Allegheny Health Network was starting this educational track for residents called the Inclusion Health Track. I knew I was really interested in working with underserved populations. I didn't totally know what that meant. I'd spent a summer in India previously doing like HIV research in really like low income neighborhoods. So I was really interested in this idea of low barrier healthcare and how it's delivered. So when I started residency, the Allegheny Health Network does provide care for people who are incarcerated currently at the Allegheny County Jail. When I was a resident, that didn't mean much more than people would come to the hospital when they were incarcerated. And it also meant that we would provide some of the healthcare within the jail. Through the Center for Inclusion Health, we had a few providers who were going into the jail to do things like HIV care. We had a few patients who came onto the service and they were so sick. It was really disappointing to see because it was people who had tried to maybe advocate for themselves while incarcerated about their healthcare and just weren't making waves. One such person was someone who came in and basically had complete numbness and the inability to move from the waist down. And no one really knew what was going on until we finally did a scan of his back when we saw metastatic disease, metastatic cancer to his back. When we looked back at his records, he'd actually had a mass in his liver that was found about 6 months earlier. But because he was incarcerated, that was never actually followed up on. While he was in the hospital with us, there was so much stigma against him receiving care. People kept telling us that they wouldn't do MRIs on him, they wouldn't carry out his care because they said that he was a child molester. I'm not sure what his charge was. I never looked that up because I don't believe that's the best way to deliver healthcare. But the craziest thing happened was this guy stayed in the hospital. And then when I did my medical ICU rotation, like a month later, I actually watched him pass away. And that to me was jarring. Yeah, he had committed a crime, I guess, and he had done something in the world that had led him to being incarcerated. But ultimately, he had no family that he could speak to. He died in the hospital with no one around him except guards. So that kind of inspired me. I worked with my mentors and I started working every Friday when I was on my ambulatory week in the jail doing HIV care with one of the providers there. So I did that for 2 years. And I think that just kind of really got me passionate about this idea that people are incarcerated and we act like they're wardens of the state, right? Like they have no rights, but that shouldn't extend to healthcare. People should still be able to achieve healthcare while they're in the jail. And when they're released, we have to figure out how to get those people out safely.
So you witnessed this bias against your patient when he was in the hospital. It makes me wonder whether there is any kind of anti-bias training component to what you're doing currently, maybe planned for the future, not for providers who are directly involved in River, but perhaps those who are interacting with clients ahead of them being released, and or providers who are sort of tangential to the program, whether you've noticed any change in how they might interact with clients who've been formerly incarcerated after working with you and your team.
I think there's been tremendous change, to be honest. I think there's been a massive movement in medical education, in bias training, trying to provide more patient-centered care. We've seen that a lot more around racism, but I think that definitely extends to marginalized populations, like the populations we're dealing with. What I found is, as much as I can tell people the statistics around incarceration and who's incarcerated, how frequently they're incarcerated, what actually has been the best measure of changing behavior and treatment of our patients is actually us doing it ourselves. I'm very, very deliberate, and so are my coworkers, about speaking about our patients in a very positive manner. For example, if I see someone in the hospital who is currently incarcerated, I usually go up to everyone and I tell them, can you imagine how difficult this person's life must be? What are some ways that we can make their life better? I can't imagine being shackled to a bed. I can't imagine not knowing what's going to happen when I leave incarceration. And I think using words like that, basically making sure that in our day-to-day language, we're being unbiased, that we're making sure we're advocating in our actions, in our thoughts.
So in 2021, you started River, and we'd be interested in hearing about how you thought up this post-incarceration care model, and if you could walk us through how it's set up.
So when I was a resident, like I mentioned before, I'd been rotating in the Allegheny County Jail, and I think I just started to think about what happens to people when they're released from jail. We had a lot of people who would come into our doors. We'd provide this exceptional healthcare while they're hospitalized. They go to the jail, they're started on all these medications. And then I would talk to patients and they didn't know where they were going when they were released from jail. And then I was fortunate to go to a conference, the Society of General Internal Medicine, where someone from the Transitions Care Clinic Network was speaking. And it was this really awesome panel about mass incarceration. And they actually had one of their community health workers talking about why this type of model is important, this post-incarceration care model. I believe their model is a little bit different than ours, but that had me inspired. I was like, if we are providing healthcare to the Allegheny County Jail. Like, why can't we have a clinic like this? And it really fit into where I work and what our modus operandi is, that we want to provide low barrier and essential healthcare for people who may not be able to access the healthcare system. So I pitched it to my mentor, who was really great and supportive and kind of just ran with some of my ideas. And I reached out to one of my colleagues, Dr. Robertson, and we talked about what would this model look like. At the same time, I was getting very interested in the idea of community health workers and what they meant for this type of space. So we kind of combined the two ideas together and we came up with the River Clinic, which is really a clinic that is, we say, community-based. So we are really focused on community-based healthcare and the idea of integrating community health workers into healthcare to provide healthcare and improving access to the social determinants of health. So we started pitching this idea to local funders, this idea that we needed a community health worker as our first hire, and our whole model would be centered around this person's experience in engaging with the community post-incarceration, their life in incarceration, and creating a healthcare model. And luckily it took.
Can you detail, even using a hypothetical example of a prototypical client, how that works as far as communication, maybe ahead of their release, if that happens, through you working with them in the program?
We have a list of patients that are kind of referred to us through the Allegheny County Jail. We work closely with the Discharge and Release Center, as well as the substance use team. So people who they feel will be really good candidates for us, so people that we need to connect with immediately, and people we need to start building that rapport with. So they go in twice a week and they meet with our clients. They tell them, hey, I'm from the River Clinic. You don't have to see us after incarceration, but I just want you to know I'm here. And honestly, just having that kind of dialogue where people can vent, they can tell them how terrible it is inside the jail, or they could tell them about their fears and what's going to happen afterwards. And starting to provide that kind of support and that safety net even before someone's released shows them that we care, that we're not there to let them down. We're not there to be punitive. We're really there to help them transition to the next part of life. So on release, the Discharge and Release Center will kind of tell us when people are leaving and give us a phone number. And our team will call people who are leaving. They also receive our phone number at release. And that way, they'll either call the community health worker or nurse navigator. They have a few numbers they can choose from. And they call us. And then our team will kind of do an assessment. So what are your immediate needs? Do you need housing? Do you need food? Do you need transportation? What are your concerns today is really how we approach it. Most of our patients do have a substance use disorder, and most of those patients have an opioid use disorder. So we also provide low barrier buprenorphine. One of the biggest reasons why people pass away following incarceration is overdose deaths. And we know that that is rapidly changing and even increasing with a change in the drug supply, especially in places like Pittsburgh. So we do telemedicine and we ensure that people have access to buprenorphine when and where they want it. They then kind of engage with our team for the following week, and then they come see us in clinic on Fridays. When they come to clinic, they meet with a host of people. They see a physician or a nurse practitioner. They see a community health worker, a patient care navigator, a nurse navigator, a social worker, and a peer recovery specialist. We don't throw all of these people on someone, obviously. Based on their needs, we direct them to the right person. So if someone is really in need of food stamps or in need of an ID, we direct them to our social worker. If someone, they can't even get to that point, right? They're like, I'm so in my substance use, I don't know how to stop, I'm really stressed out, we direct them to our peer navigator. If it's someone who they just want like a really great word of encouragement, we direct them to our community health worker. We also have a psychiatrist that is there for a few hours on Friday. And so people with really critical mental health needs, we ensure they are seen by a psychiatrist. They stay with us for however long they need. We provide primary care, substance use treatment, and we also treat a lot of hepatitis C. We're really passionate about that because that's an easy win for a lot of our patients. Once they seem like they're pretty stable, we get them moving along. We get them to a primary care office that's closer to them, but we're more of a transitional clinic, and we really emphasize that with our patients. We want to get them back on their feet. And once they're on their feet, they should go somewhere that makes sense for their healthcare.
It's really interesting because the team that you have in the clinic, they're coming from multiple disciplines. And from the outset, was that imperative that you needed to have this diverse team of professionals?
We were, again, very deliberate about that. I think when Dr. Robertson and I talk about why we created this clinic and what the function of our clinic is, we always say the healthcare is on the back burner. Our job is maybe to make things run, but the team, the community health workers, the social worker, the nurse navigator, the peer recovery specialist, they are the people that everyone wants to engage with. They are the reason that our clinic can be successful. They're out there Monday through Thursday, just out in the community, trying to find people, trying to advocate for them, working with them.
You know, it's 2 years now that the clinic has been running, and we'd be interested to hear about sort of the main objectives that your team pursued.
Our first objective is to treat everyone like a human. Our major goal is that everyone we interact with feels that. We want them to feel like they are worth it, they are respected, they are loved, because so many of our patients have not received that at the hands of healthcare and at the hands of institutional systems. Because why would anyone call a doctor when they're released from jail? They have to get housing, they have to get an ID, they have to figure out where their next meal is coming from, they have to figure out if they're going to continue their substance use, they have to figure out all these criminal legal proceedings that are much more complicated than accessing healthcare. So we had the idea that we'd get a community health worker, so someone who has a history of being incarcerated, but on top of that, really is a member of the community. She is from one of the neighborhoods in Pittsburgh that has the highest incarceration rates. So these are people that she knows and she's comfortable with. Like, she understands what social determinants of health people in this neighborhood are facing. Her and our social worker go into the Allegheny County Jail twice a week. From a more practical standpoint, like data that we would look at, initially we were thinking about recidivism and return to incarceration as a major one. And what we found is that, you know, when you go to jail, the thing is, no one serves a full sentence. So someone might have 10 warrants and they only get arrested on one of those warrants. They serve that sentence, but they still have 9 warrants out. So they still have 9 sentences of incarceration to fulfill, which is kind of crazy to think about. It's not like someone goes there and they just get it all done at once. That's not how the system works. So what we found is that even if we did all these things for our patients, they still might be reincarcerated from past warrants. So our objective at this point is to get someone to not have new charges on their record. And if there is a chance that they could be incarcerated, we really go to bat for them. We often send our social worker or our community health workers into the courtroom to be like, hey, this is why they're doing really, really well. And incarceration isn't going to fix that. What they need is to be out here and trying their best. Other things that we really care about are overdose deaths, which is, you know, always going up and always changing. We really operate from a harm reduction aspect, meaning that we believe that drug use is going to happen, but what we need to do is keep our patients safe. And so we are really focused on this idea of low barrier access to treatment if someone's interested in that. We talk a lot to our patients about, how do you not die? Like, how do we make sure that you can live another day and that next day that you can make decisions that you want to be living with? We are focused on just this idea that it takes a community. We know we're not saviors. We're nothing like that. But what we can do is give people a safety net that incarceration doesn't have to be the end of someone's life. We can use that as a jumping board to get someone to a more meaningful life where they don't have to go through the revolving door.
Sometimes there isn't much warning when someone's going to be rearrested. So do they just call someone on your team? Or is there any kind of working relationship with the court system where that's a level of communication that could happen?
There's a few different ways that it can happen. So one of them is, some of our patients do know when they're going to court. So we'll write them a letter, or someone will go with them to court depending on their court date. If someone is rearrested, we don't have as much control there. But oftentimes, if someone knows that they're involved with River Clinic, they might call us, especially the parole and probation officers. A lot of them have our number. We are working actively on getting more involved with the court system, because that's like a huge gap that we're seeing. It's tough because those court systems change a lot and there's new judges and there's new public defenders that are coming up, but we are working on closing that gap. When we can advocate, when we do know that someone is going to court, we do our best to advocate for them. And if someone is incarcerated, we work within the jail to make sure that people get optimal health care to the best of our ability.
We've seen our profession hit hard over the years and coverage gaps widen, as there are far fewer journalists working today than when we started out.
The result is stories are simply being missed, especially what we call obscured stories. They happen largely out of the public eye and involve critical issues that are complex and often overshadowed.
That's why we've launched Obscured, to help give these types of stories the attention they deserve.
We value high-impact journalism and its capacity to broaden knowledge, catalyze public scrutiny, drive accountability, and shift policy.
and we hope you do as well, and will please consider becoming a supporter of Obscured with a tax-deductible contribution before the year comes to a close.
Your year-end gift will help support our ongoing research, reporting, writing, editing, and audio production that's happening behind the scenes to create the first season of Obscured and our From Words to Weapons series. Contributions can be made online at cuvendamedia.com/support.
We're grateful for you taking time to listen to Obscured and wish you all the best for this holiday season.
As part of Obscured, we've been telling you about other podcasts you might like. Democracy Works delves into a unique aspect of democratic life each week, including voting rights, criminal justice, the free press, and much more. Listeners have described the show as thoughtful, insightful political discussion and as a source of hope for American politics and the future of our country. Democracy Works is produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU, Central Pennsylvania's NPR station. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And to what extent is law enforcement involved with the program? That could be on the front end, just giving some feedback to the setup.
The law enforcement agents that do know about us seem to like us. Like, they'll tell patients, like, oh, you're involved with River Clinic. That's really good. We haven't worked directly with law enforcement. And I think it's very neighborhood dependent. There's different zones of police officers. And I think some zones know who we are and some zones could care less who we are. And that's the reality of it. Someone being involved with us hasn't led to less arrests, unfortunately. It hasn't led to less interactions with the police force as far as we know. But what we do know is when people do end up close to incarceration, involvement in our program can help. But I think that what you're saying is a good point. I mean, I think that that is kind of a next step for us too, right? Is like, how do we get involved more with law enforcement? Law enforcement's complicated. I think as we work more with parole and probation and as our name gets out there, I would hope that that does change our relationship with law enforcement in the future.
Our podcast is focused on survivors of law enforcement trauma for this first series. And to what extent is that coming up with patients you're seeing, clients you're serving?
It comes up very frequently. We have so many patients who have injuries from interactions with law enforcement who tell us that they're scared, that they don't like to see police officers, that they're really worried about just even interacting with a probation officer sometimes. It comes up very, very often. And it's alarming and it's sad. A lot of our patients have PTSD from interactions by being incarcerated, from interactions with law enforcement. So it is something we see often. And it's hard, right? Because other than giving people support and the idea that you can find trust in an institution, which is, you know, healthcare for right now, and our community health workers, I'm not sure how you solve that trauma yet, to be honest. I think we do a lot of what was traumatizing about it. How do you de-escalate those situations when you're in them? Who can you call in those situations so you know that it doesn't have to be escalated? I don't know how you solve that, but that is something that our patients face very frequently.
Yeah, that's tricky because if someone, while incarcerated, needs care, especially, and it seems like then somebody from law enforcement would be escorting them to the clinic or, you know, the hospital, and would the social worker or the psychiatrist sort of be there for like a warm handoff or something to help mitigate potential triggers that are coming up during that time? I mean, how do you problem solve for that interaction?
Well, number one, I think our presence in the jail is really helpful because even though there are officers there, you know, they see our team and they see our team interacting with the officers and advocating for them. It doesn't mitigate the trauma that they might be facing dealing with an officer or just being in a correctional institution, but it does at least make the environment feel a bit more tolerable. Also, when people are hospitalized while incarcerated, someone from our team does come see them. So we go see them in the hospital. We let them know that we're here to support them. We're here to talk to them. Our peer recovery specialist, who does most of that work, has developed a really good rapport with those patients and just kind of sits at the bedside, lets them know that we're here. And I think, kind of like you were saying, how do we mitigate those stressors? I think in healthcare itself, we can do that, right? So if someone comes to our office and they're incarcerated and they're in cuffs, treating them humanely, you know, still doing a physical exam, even though there's officers in the room, still sitting down at the bedside and talking to our patients instead of running in and running out, being like, oh, they're incarcerated, I have no control over this. We have control over how someone feels and how we make them feel. And I think that's kind of a lesson that I've learned doing this work, is that just because someone's incarcerated, that doesn't mean that just because we can't control everything that's going to happen when they are incarcerated, what we can do is change the way that they feel in that moment.
You've touched on this. It seems like you and your team have a long-term, relatively, definitely a multi-step strategy or multiple steps that go toward establishing trust. And that comes back to the institution's questions. You know, you mentioned visiting them in the hospital and being in the jail and out in the community. And so that may impact their perception or trust in the medical establishment. Is there anything that's coming up that's more direct and articulated specifically about mistrust in institutions that you and your team are addressing with clients, or perhaps identifying the need to address to more effectively serve them?
I think that most of our patients don't want to trust us when they see us. That's like the reality of it. Most of the people we work with, they love talking to our community health worker because she's really cool. They love talking to our office staff. But when it comes to actually talking to the providers, I think that there's a huge gap there. And it comes up. I literally had a patient tell me last week, well, you don't want to give me this medication because you think I'm an addict. And I was like, I do not feel that way about you. I'm telling you my medical opinion about this, you know? And that was someone we'd been working with for like a month, someone I developed a very good relationship with. So that trauma and that distrust in institutions and what providers have done, what officers have done, whatever it is, whatever institutions have made our people distrust us so heavily, that's always going to exist. And we just have to keep driving it home. Like, hey, that's not what I think. What I care about is you. My focus is you in this moment. My only job is to care about you. And that's what I usually tell them. And even if I do have a situation with a patient where I am saying no to something, I usually check with someone else in the clinic. I'm like, hey, I'm about to say no to this. I want you to make sure I'm checking my biases. Like, am I being biased? Am I doing something that I'm doing this because they're irritating me or it's frustrating? All of us do that. We check ourselves. If I feel myself getting tense in a situation, I often step away and I ask someone else, like, hey, what could I be doing better in this situation? And I think that's helped us a lot too, because our patients have been treated badly by institutions. And we have to make sure that we're constantly checking our biases and kind of like what we're doing to make sure that we're not feeding into that mistrust that they already have.
How do you think you tap into that? Because you're sort of in the heat of the moment, and to be able to have that awareness to step out. And, you know, in medical education, how much is that emphasized and how much is that maybe coming from you as a individual, or is it a combination? You know, to have that tendency to be able to remove yourself, pause, take stock.
And I think it's being emphasized in medical education more and more. When I was in residency, we talked a lot about bias training. You know, we have like morbidity and mortality conferences where we'd always talk about biases. And I think that really started me thinking like, okay, so how do I address my biases on a daily basis? And when I would talk to patients about why they were frustrated in their healthcare, that's when it really hit me. Like, it's because we're seeing, for a lot of providers, they're seeing like 30 patients a day, right? And they're running. Like, they have so many things going on. And so when something gets frustrating, it's really hard to be like, oh my God, I'm getting frustrated because this is a frustrating situation and not because you're mad at that person. And I think after thinking about that for a really long time and trying to figure out how I could be a better provider, I realized that being able to check my bias in the situation is actually going to be much better. It also like applies to regular life. When you're mad at someone or you're getting frustrated in a situation, it's good to think about, am I mad at this person or am I just frustrated about something else? So I think I've done it as a trick because I think it's good for regular life and it's good as a provider, you know?
In listening to you talk about setting up River and your experiences in the jail ahead of that and what kind of got the wheels turning, did you ever encounter pushback, resistance, or just a lack of encouragement to maybe even earlier on working with this population, but then also when you were actually going through the steps to set up River, coordinate resources? I mean, it's a big endeavor.
There were some parts of it that were easier, and there were some parts of it that were harder. As an institution, the place that I work, we had a lot of support, and we're really, really fortunate for that. I think it was a glaring hole, and I think we were able to present a good case for why this clinic needed to start. So starting it where we work, that was fairly smooth sailing, and I think it's because we had really, really great leadership who supported us in that. However, I think there have been a lot of really hard parts about it. Everyone perceives this population differently. People are like, oh, well, they're the victim. Oh, well, you know, they're just going to return to drug use. Oh, well, they don't really deserve that, do they? We hear that all the time. They're just going to get reincarcerated. They're going to overdose. They are at the hands of a much larger problem than we can fix by just coming to clinic to see us. A lot of community organizations were like, what are you doing? Like, why do you want to work with this population? They're just going to go back to jail. And we had to fight that. We also had to fight within the county system to tell them like, hey, I understand that you feel like this person's not good and that you believe that substance use disorders are this way, but we're telling you that it's not. And we're telling you this because we love this population and that we care for them. What that really took was that we took it on. We owned it. We didn't let it be like, hey, this is a problem we're all going to solve together. We were like, we're going to own this population. We are going to advocate for them till our dying breath, and we're going to do what we can. It also took a lot of community buy-in. And I think that's where you get people like community health workers. We don't rely in research and in healthcare enough on people with lived experience. And honestly, those are the people who should be at the table. We have two community health workers, a peer recovery specialist, and even our nurse navigator. They're all from areas where we are seeing high incarceration and high overdose rates. So when they're going back to their communities being like, I'm in this clinic, we need to fight for our people, it is so much more meaningful and so much more powerful than if I were to go there and I was like, hey, I'm starting this clinic. What do you guys think? Do you know what I mean? And so I think it's really leveraging the idea that lived experience and people from these communities should be brought to the table. And hiring like that is really important. A lot of times when we do research, I think it's really focused on, oh, well, like, there's a problem. Like, why is there a problem? And this idea that you just have to go fix systems. And fixing a system isn't just like doing a whole overhaul, even though that's what I think a lot of systems probably need. It's taking the baby steps and making these micro changes really to make change actually happen. I think that's how we got our footing. Literally, when we started the clinic and we had hired our community health worker, we were still trying to figure out what we were doing. We were like, we just need to start seeing patients. We don't know how to do this. She literally would drive around the neighborhoods in Pittsburgh and just stop by organizations. She's wonderful, but we relied on that and we told her to do that. You know, we told everyone in our clinic, if you are passionate about something with this population, do it and tell us later. That's okay. If you want to go talk to an organization, we're not going to stop you. And that's how you do this work, is that we cannot rely on being at academic institutions or healthcare systems and being from this like place and looking down. We have to be in the community and looking up. And that's how you make change. And that's how you get this work off the ground, I think.
It also sounds like you have given the team members the latitude to come up with organic solutions that aren't hampered by some kind of rigid framework, and being able to have that breadth to be able to explore, experiment, and know it may not work out. Okay, I have the ability to try another tactic. And that's certainly harder, but what it sounds like is maybe then the impact, you might be getting closer to a solution that's a better fit.
That's absolutely true. And I think it's also because, like, I don't think me or Dr. Robertson think that we have all the answers. I don't know everything. I know very little, you know, and I think that the people that we've hired were really lucky that they know a lot. We have to put all of our heads together in order to come up with a solution. And I think that solution lies in the community. That solution lies in where our patients end up. It's not that one time they come to clinic and things are hard, right? It's that they go home and they have to live at home. They have to find a home. They have to figure out what does home mean to them. They have to figure out what does life mean to them. And so having our team really go out there and come up with solutions themselves, because they're all solution-oriented people, them informing us about what our best practices should be, that's really what's made our clinic thrive and be successful, I think, compared to other models, I guess. I think that's where we found our success, is we've leveraged the people we work with and made sure that they feel empowered to make decisions.
On that note, you're 2 years in with the clinic, and could you share some of the clinical outcomes that have really come to the forefront for you and your team?
We've interacted with over 500 patients at this point, which has been really incredible. We have provided bridge prescriptions basically for, I think, about 95% of those people. So anyone who's actually contacted us, we've always been able to provide a bridge prescription of buprenorphine. And that's also incredible. We answer the phone right away. We get them the medication that they need. There was a study that came out a few years ago about deaths following incarceration. And it was one of the leading causes was overdose deaths. And people who had been incarcerated were 12 times more likely to die in the 2 weeks post-release. And out of all of the patients we've interacted with, we've only had two patients overdose and pass away. And only one of those was in the immediate post-incarceration period. That was a complicated situation, but that also feels like a pretty good success. We've treated over 15 patients for hepatitis C, which you can imagine is our patients are going in and out of jail. Like, they're not people who are staying in treatment with us the whole time. And we've done that by actually bringing people their medications directly to their homes, to wherever they are, to their shelters, and even to the jail to ensure that they can continue and complete treatment. There's a lot of really good statistics, but I'll tell you guys a story that I think this to me is a success of our clinic more than anything. We had a patient who was kind of seeing us intermittently, really didn't want to talk to us whenever they would come into the clinic. We were pretty worried about this person. And then our community health worker saw this person while they were incarcerated and totally changed the trajectory. So they're with us, then they were incarcerated again. And then this person's trajectory totally changed. This person was able to go to a treatment center and is now doing really, really well. And it was literally because our community health worker saw them while the person was in clinic. The person kind of like knew who our community health worker was, didn't really say much to them. But when they went back to jail, the person that they wanted to see and the person that impacted the way that they then saw their treatment was the community health worker. And we've had multiple success stories like that. So it's not about that first engagement being the most impactful. It's that constantly being there, constantly providing a safety net for someone so that they know that no matter what hits them, we're always going to be there for them. And this person's going to come to our clinic again and is really, really excited. I spoke to them on the phone and I've never heard this person sound so positive. And it was literally because our community health worker was there the whole time. And that's kind of what everyone in our clinic does. That's what each member of our team does, is we're always there. So someone might return to use, but guess what? It doesn't matter to us because we're always going to love them and care for them and hopefully get them through incarceration.
Was there anything that you wanted to talk about that we didn't touch on, or, you know, any final thoughts or another point?
I think the only thing that I would add is that when we embark on this type of work and we start thinking about underserved populations, what has to be at the center of our minds and what we're doing is that every person is a human. Every person deserves to be treated with dignity and humanity. So even when we're doing research, the goal isn't just to achieve an outcome because we have to achieve an outcome, right? It's that every person deserves to have a really good life, whatever that means for them. And so we have to be understanding of where they come from. We have to meet people really where they're at. Like, this idea of harm reduction isn't just like overdose prevention sites and things like that. It's more than that. It's this idea that every person has the right to live freely and happily. And so when we do this kind of work, whether it's someone who's interacted with law enforcement, whether it's someone who uses drugs, whether it's someone who's experiencing homelessness, everyone deserves that humanity and dignity. And meeting people where they are, that's how we're going to achieve the best health outcomes for people and also the best quality of life, I think.
Yeah, and I think with this approach, right, it's like when you put that front and center, it will drive the delivery of care in a way that differentiates from sort of the traditional medical experience. But to your point, just sort of thinking, what would be the hierarchy here if there is one? You know, does the harm reduction model encompass social determinants of health and low barrier access? Is that sort of then the way to think about this?
Yeah, I mean, I think harm reduction approach should be how we all deliver healthcare. You know, meeting people where they are, really creating space, opening options for people. And I think once you start doing that, it's easier to approach the social determinants of health. And ultimately, not everyone's going to choose to provide low barrier care, but that is under the umbrella of it all. Because once you can tackle those things, the idea of doing low barrier care, it's not intimidating. It's part of what you do.
Thank you so much for making the time to have this conversation, Divya. It was just a joy and a privilege to be able to talk to you about your work.
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak. It's been a really great conversation with both of you.
Thanks for being here.
Special thanks to Divya for joining us. For more about her work, we've provided a link in our show notes. And for more about Obscured and our work,
You can stay up to date with us on social at Kuvenda Media. Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Our series was edited by Diane Hodson and fact-checked by Chelsea Zhu. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of the series. Stephanie Marudis is Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator. And I'm executive editor and co-creator of Obscured.
We want to thank Obscured's fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, which is one of the oldest media change organizations in the United States and helps our podcast receive tax-deductible contributions. And we're grateful to Obscured's founding supporters who've made donations to support our journalism initiative. And if you like what you've heard so far, please join our community of listeners. For more about how to support Obscured, head online to kuvendamedia.com/support.
You can also help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing the series with others. I'm Emily Previty. Thanks for listening.